after coming to Penn and starting to work with Dan Hunt, who was a professor here, having come from Harvard, where he developed the lung-on-a-chip, I really was blown away by this ability to see human tissue growing in a piece of plastic in front of me. And these two worlds of extremely complex biology and extremely high throughput experimentation in microfluidics came together so elegantly, and the ability to take those complex tissues and to scale them with the power of high throughput microfluidics.
So there are studies currently, and as papers are coming out and showing the power of this technology, I think that things don't take off in a linear way. They take off more with a turning point.
In semiconductors, we're all familiar with Moore's law, where the number of transistors is doubling every time period. And in biology, we face Eroom's law, which is the opposite, which says the cost of a drug is improving sort of in line with Moore's law. And the cost of that drug is not because drug hunters are being frivolous. It's not that we're spending money for the sake of it. It's that it's getting harder. And so there's more failure. And then the failure rate has not really changed over many years. We're still today, 90% of drugs that are discovered are failing before they reach the market.
Welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast, where you can learn from entrepreneurs and investors who are driving progress in healthcare and life science around the globe. Hello, this is Alex Merwin from AWS. The relentless pursuit of innovation in healthcare and life sciences continues to inspire and amaze. We meet a lot of incredible innovators on the show, so we thought it'd be fun to do something a little different and compile a five-part mini-series with each episode featuring a different stage of the health innovation lifecycle. Part one, today, we will dive into the cutting-edge world of drug research and development, where visionary companies are harnessing the power of engineering, artificial intelligence, and novel technologies to revolutionize how we discover and design new therapies. In the coming weeks, we'll feature diagnostics and biomarkers, clinical trials, clinician and patient experience, real-world evidence, and population health. We will start today's episode hearing from Vivadyne, a pioneer in microfluidic bioengineering, who developed a groundbreaking platform capable of growing tens of thousands of human tissue samples at scale. By precisely controlling microenvironments, they can study complex cell interactions and dynamics that drive disease, bridging the gap between preclinical results and human responses. Seer, a biotechnology company, is unlocking the secrets of the proteome, the full set of proteins in the body, using engineered nanoparticles and mass spectrometry. Their unbiased, deep, and large-scale approach promises to uncover insights into complex biological systems, paving the way for new diagnostic and therapeutic breakthroughs. Ordeos, a human-enabled, machine-driven drug design company, is tackling the high failure rates and costs of traditional drug development by using AI to design optimal mini-protein molecules from scratch. These mini-proteins combine the advantages of small molecules and antibodies, offering benefits like oral delivery, crossing the blood-brain barrier, and tumor penetration. In Silico Medicine, a pioneer in generative AI for drug discovery, is reimagining the entire pharmaceutical pipeline. By leveraging technologies like generative adversarial networks, they aim to accelerate the traditionally slow and costly process of bringing new drugs to market. Alchemab Therapeutics is taking a unique approach to developing antibody therapies by identifying protective antibodies from resilient patient populations. By combining machine learning with experimental validation, they are accelerating the discovery and design of antibodies for hard-to-treat diseases like neurodegenerative disorders and cancers. In this episode, we'll explore how all these innovative companies are pushing the boundaries of what's possible in drug research and development, leveraging cutting-edge technologies to tackle some of the most challenging problems in life science. But enough from me, let's get started. Our guest is Andrei Georgescu, the CEO of Vivadyne. Vivadyne has developed a groundbreaking microfluidic bioengineering platform capable of growing tens of thousands of human tissue samples at scale.
I'm curious, as an engineer, like your first foray into biology, what struck you the most as, oh my gosh, we're still in the dark ages. There's just so much, you know, potential to transform how we do things in sciences and where we can learn and pull in lessons from other disciplines.
The thing that struck me the most when I was a kid getting my bearings in engineering, the things that fascinated me most were like the simple mechanisms behind, I remember like my VCR trying to figure out the linkage of a VHS cassette going in and being loaded into the VCR itself and like being mesmerized by the little, whatever, 3-4 bar little linkages that are moving the thing inside. And then, so I developed this kind of fascination with mechanisms to make things move. And then got into biology and you see this incredible stack up of far more sophisticated mechanisms, right? There are the most common example is the hydrogen like turbine on mitochondria that generates power from the gradient of protons, but also things like that 70% of the genome that we all thought was remnants of viral infections and stuff and our ancestors and so on becoming this really critical region for pulling DNA together and exposing a read site or exposing a promoter for something, or just the cycling of proteins through cells, the way that they tag certain vesicles to send them to different locations. Like all of these things really spoke to me as an engineer, and they spoke to me in this, all right, like what we're doing as people is trivial in comparison, right? Especially at the scale that a cell does them. And this is, I think, anyone probably listening, but this seems like a trivial, oh, wow, I was blown away by biology. But it was, to me, it just felt so profound because I was like, we have the sophistication right here in front of us. It just became, I don't know, so obvious in my own head that there was so much that we could leverage within that depth.
Yeah. I think what's so impressive about biology is just you can keep digging. If you take it from an engineering perspective, how do you break down a lot of complexity into sort of simple building blocks? And I think what's always shocking is just even for a simple building block, there's additional building blocks that continue to form that. Just the overall complexity of it and what feels like an infinite search space, right, as you're trying to tackle problems.
Yep. And I think there's like this, what is the hardest thing about biology in my mind is, especially with a lot of the recent instrumentation that's been developed in cryo-electron microscopy and in single cell sequencing and a lot of these like huge advances, we've been able to go very deep down the rabbit holes. So if I'm wondering what this exonic sequence in the DNA actually does, I can find the protein produced by that sequence and I can isolate it and I can image it in cryo-EM and understand the structure and I can look at where it's expressed in certain cells and I can really dig deep on that one protein. But the integrative knowledge that we have about biology that says, if I make a small change to this protein, how does that propagate to every other rabbit hole that we have dug is like surprisingly sparse. So when we are developing drugs, we're hitting a single target. And that is because we know what that target does. And what we try to then spend the rest of the drug development cycle trying to figure out is what else does it do, right? How does it affect everything else around it? Yeah, it's an exciting feeling to feel like you're at the frontier of trying to figure that part out, which is where my own kind of deep interest is. Like how can we connect all these rabbit holes together?
Yeah, and create better model systems in biology. I think a lot of these things are one-off and the processes to get to certain outcomes is very bespoke. And so now I think with the advent of just huge amounts of data with AI ML, but even generating new types of data, how to use all of that in a very systematic way so that we can generate better models in this space. All right, I want to go back to lab on a chip because this is just an area that is just so fascinating. I feel like there's just so much new developments that are coming out of it. For people who aren't familiar, can you tell us a little bit more about how the technology for lab on a chip evolved and what specifically when you think about organ on a chip, right? What does it enable us to do that we couldn't do before?
Totally. So the kind of fundamental concept of lab on a chip through microfluidics, and this is still a bit away from the biology side, but like, what does it fundamentally do and why do it? If we think of a mechanical engineering process, like building a car, you have these massive warehouses and the cars are big and you can put them through all these different stations and have different operations executed on those cars. In chemistry, each part of that car is very small. And so you do not need to create, you know, massive volumes. And I say massive, like milliliter scale volumes are pretty massive compared to the size of one, you know, molecule. You don't need to create volumes that large to perform some experiment in chemistry or perform some process. And usually the difficulties in working with very large batch sizes are a kind of loss of control of what is happening on the small scale. And so you get irregularities in the mixing of a mixing tank, or you get temperature gradients in some process chamber or what have you. And if you can miniaturize that and integrate an entire assembly line onto a microfluidic device, you are still working with volumes that are, you know, again, relative to the molecule, quite large. And so you can make, let's say, hundreds or thousands or billions of those molecules and still be in this very small millimeter scale or a micron scale or even smaller form factor. But you get a huge amount of control over those reactions because fluids tend to behave much more predictably at very small scales, right? You have these viscous forces that dominate and there's no turbulence, right? Both in a figurative sense, like no chaotic behavior, but also in a physical sense. Everything flows where you expect it to and so forth. And so in a lot of chemical processing, there's huge advantages to be gained from working at those scales in consistency and in like even the ability to monitor and understand what's happening in a process. But the difficulty is in taking like interfacing that microfluidic system or that lab on a chip to the rest of the world or the rest of the lab, right? So like the chip to world interface often ends up being a bottleneck and becomes the thing that prevents us from really being this manufacturing plant type of system. You need scientists or technicians to sit and work with the thing. Now with biology, one of the big kind of benefits that carry over to trying to grow, starting with single cells and all the way to much more complex, like physiological scale systems in those microfluidics, is all those benefits of control that labs on a chip offer, you can carry right over. And you have control over the gradients of different chemicals and growth factors that are kind of presented to these cells and these tissues. You have control over gradients of even cells that you're inserting into these devices. You can sample from very small volumes and you don't need like entire humans worth of cells to perform an experiment, especially if the behaviors and the kind of kinetics and dynamics of that system operate on a small enough scale, let's say across a few hundred thousand cells, they can scale them down. And so really the benefit is you can control very carefully the interface between the engineering part of a system and the biology part and ensure a great degree of consistency to that.
I don't feel like we gave it enough airtime, but the company has such a cool technology platform. I want to spend some time and just have you tell us what is the core technology capability of the Vivadyne.
Sure. So we talk a lot about microfluidics and a bit about biology. The fundamental mission of our company is to produce huge quantities of human data without actually needing to go to clinical trials and gather that data from like actual people. And this, like the desire to want to have data before clinical trials is not a novel one. It's the reason why we do animal tests, the reason why we have many assays with cell lines and petri dishes. But there are really drastic shortcomings to the quality of the data that results from either of those. From very simple studies with cells growing in a petri dish, we are cutting out so much of the complexity of biology and we are reducing it to just one very homogenous kind of layer of cells growing flat on plastic. And the interactions between that cell type and everything else by which it would be surrounded in the human body suddenly gets cut out. And so if we have a drug, for example, that stops the growth of new blood vessels into a tumor, and we are looking at how that drug affects the cells that make blood vessels by growing flat on a dish, like we might not see that outcome or that interaction in such a simple system. And by cutting out this huge, I'd say majority kind of subset of complex interactions and dynamics in the body, we are not able to map the results we get in our early studies to what happens in people in clinical trials. And especially if we're cutting out the interactions at which like disease actually manifests, right? So we move to animals, which are far more complex. They're as complex as we are. Like a mouse is definitely smaller than a person, but all of its complexity and our complexity is still there. It has all the same organ systems. It has many of the same hormones and signaling and all that. There's a lot that is conserved. But the really tricky part with animals is a mouse and a person, to use like a machine learning analogy, they're almost like two fine-tuned models of a common like mammalian development kind of base.
Today, we welcome Seer to the show, who are pioneering new ways to decode the secrets of this incredibly detailed landscape to improve human health. Seer leverages engineered nanoparticles to provide unbiased, deep, and large-scale access to the proteome.
Can you tell us about the main problem that Seer is trying to solve and the unique approach that you are taking to do so?
Seer is developing technologies to decipher the proteome. So let me say a few words about the proteome. As each one of us has a genome, and that is given to us at birth, and each one of the roughly 30 trillion cells in our body have a nearly identical copy of that genome. The genome roughly contains 20,000 genes, and each gene is like a blueprint for producing a protein, or in most cases, actually more than one protein, several forms of protein. So we have a genome and we have a proteome. However, the proteome is highly dynamic. So even though our cells have the same genome, roughly, throughout our lifetime, the proteome varies according to condition, according to cell type, tissue, and time of the day, time in the cell cycle, environmental conditions, and so on. So proteins are really the building blocks of life. They are involved in every biological function, including the structure of the cell and its organelles, including communication across cells, including being little machines within a cell, such as motors and cleavers, catalyzing biochemical reactions, and so on. So the proteome is extremely complex and also extremely informative. So if we have the proteome of different cells in different conditions and different time points, or if we have the proteome of individuals across a study such as a disease study of cases and controls, or a longitudinal study of individuals and their health, and we have data on their proteome, perhaps accessible proteomes like plasma, we can in principle learn a lot about health, disease, and how to treat disease. So that is why the proteome is so important. And unfortunately, the proteome has lagged behind the genome in terms of being deciphered. And there is many reasons for that, including just the technologies were developed faster for the genome. It was the first thing we attacked. Also that the proteome is more difficult. So we have, the genome is really a very clean digital code in one huge macromolecule consisting of 23 chromosomes. The proteome consists of about, well, many more than 20,000 proteins and their variants, including splice variants, allelic variants, as well as post-translational modifications. So even the same protein becomes different versions of it and performs different functions at different times. Another level of complexity is the dynamic range of the proteome in certain highly accessible biofluids, such as plasma in particular. So that means that certain proteins are very abundant, such as albumin in plasma, and other proteins that are also extremely important are many orders of magnitude, maybe as many as 8 orders of magnitude lower in abundance. So finding these needles in a haystack has been to date very complex. So SEER develops technologies that aim to go deep in the proteome, meaning finding even the low abundance proteins, and to also detect all the variants of the proteins. So not just have one readout per general protein group, but have much more than that. So we use nanoparticle technology to collect proteins across the dynamic range in complex samples such as plasma. And then we couple this with mass spectrometry, which is a well-established technology, and it's really the gold standard for finding proteins and their proteoforms, as well as, luckily, there is recently very good developments vastly improving this technology. So really look for having a combined solution that is going deep and very scalably, so we can analyze large human cohorts.
Why is using nanoparticles such a game changer in understanding the proteome?
So let me say a couple of words of how it works and why it is a game changer, from my perspective. How it works, nanoparticles, when basically incubated in a biofluid, such as plasma, form a corona around them. A corona is basically, proteins go and stick around the nanoparticle and basically form a large combined structure. And proteins stick on top of other proteins and so on. So you have like multiple layers of this corona. There is an effect called the Vroman effect, for which basically, initially maybe you get the most abundant proteins to cover the nanoparticle. But if you let it a few minutes, over time, proteins that have higher affinity displace the abundant ones and attach. Now, in principle, there is no reason why a given nanoparticle would collect proteins across the dynamic range from the abundant ones to the less abundant ones. It could be that maybe the nanoparticles, the best protein that sticks there is the most abundant one. So then it wouldn't work. In practice, we have designed nanoparticles that work empirically very well. So they collect proteins across the dynamic range reliably. So you can quantitatively tell between several samples, longitudinally or across different individuals, when a given protein goes up or down. Not its precise quantity, but definitely its fold change across the sample. That's what you need to do downstream computational analysis. So does it work? Well, to date, until a few months ago, our ability was about 5 times more proteins than if you don't do the nanoparticle assay in plasma. And in different biosamples, we have different performance. With the newest technology, what we find now with the Astral machine by Thermo, which is an incredible instrument that goes twice as deep as previous ones. So one would think maybe your ability is now going down compared because NEAT is catching up. The truth is that we now go 8 times as deep. So it's even better. So my answer as a computer scientist, I look at data, is that empirically it works. And that's what one needs. Now we have a great ability to develop more and more nanoparticles and to optimize them across the nanoparticle in the way, the precise assay. So that's a lot of what we're doing in research. We have some guided work on that as well. We try to understand the principles of it. So we have a large collection of hundreds of nanoparticles and mixes of them. And of course, we release as product the ones that work best.
You recently authored a very comprehensive article about large language models in molecular biology and towards data science, something that I greatly enjoyed reading. Given the hype around Gen AI at the moment, how bullish are you on the ability of LLMs to truly uncover insights into biological processes, just given the complexity of biological systems and the many blind spots we have?
Absolutely. That's a great question. I am more bullish about biological systems being decipherable by LLMs than I'm bullish about LLMs in general. I have expressed even on Twitter and so on my skepticism about the ability of LLMs to reason at the level of a human. I don't think we have quite, we are close to artificial general intelligence or to human mathematician or human physicist and so on. But in biology in particular, I think we have developed enough technology to really decipher a lot of molecular biology. So let me explain why is that. Biology is incredibly complex. I would say too complex for humans. That's why we make rules that every principle in biology works 70 or 80 or 90%. So what is going on? Biology is composed of millions and trillions and billions of components and interactions. So we have 20,000 genes, 1 million different proteins and proteoforms and states of proteins, and those interact in multitudes of ways. Those interactions have evolved across billions of years and quadrillions of organisms. And by evolved, it means that the ones that confer fitness, or at least don't do something too bad, stay. And so we have systems that are very robust. There, the knowledge of this system, how this system works, is not a few principles like, say, okay, I discovered general relativity or quantum electrodynamics. It's not a few formulas that govern the system. It is a million or a billion little rules. So that's where the LLMs are really good at. Given sufficient data, given lots and lots of functional genomic readouts, and we have an increased ability, we have now practically hundreds of different assay types that we can do in cell samples. And sometimes also in single cells, we have a large number of assays that we can do in single cells even. And those readouts give us statistical information as to the interactions of those entities, of those millions of entities. Which protein binds to which part of the DNA, which gene regulates which other gene, and so on. Humans cannot decipher that, but given more and more data, The LLM learns millions and millions of literal rules that statistically give the predictive ability on the system. So that's why I think LLMs are particularly, and this is not just theoretical. If we look at the literature of the past really 3-4 years, as I said also in my Towards Data Science essay, we see lots of problems one by one, which were considered grand challenges or very difficult problems. All of a sudden, we get neural networks, not always LLMs. Anything that works is good empirically, but typically LLM, most of them LLMs that basically make huge breakthroughs on those problems. The best example is perhaps AlphaFold, which learned protein folding. It didn't really learn to the dynamics of how a protein folds or the principles or the energy function. What it learned is to put together millions of little rules that those amino acids tend to go together this way. So that basically, and many other examples, which I cover also in my essay, but I bet you that in the next 3 months, even this essay will be completely obsolete. We will have better examples. So really, LLMs are really eating molecular biology right now.
In this episode, Dave Longo, the CEO of Ordeos, discusses the challenges faced by the pharmaceutical industry, such as high failure rates and rising costs, and how Ordeos is tackling these issues by designing optimal drug molecules upfront using AI and technology. Dave will share Ordeos' unique approach, which involves using mini-agent systems and distributed learning to model complex biological systems like proteins.
We're all aware of the larger challenges facing the industry right now, but from your perspective, what are the most pressing challenges that you see, and how do you see Ordeos integrating in to address those?
Yeah, so in semiconductors, we're all familiar with Moore's law, where number of transistors is doubling every time period. And in biology, we face Eron's law, which is the opposite, which says the cost of a drug is in line with Moore's law. And the cost of that drug is not because drug hunters are being frivolous. It's not that we're spending money for the sake of it. It's that it's getting harder. And so there's more failure. And then the failure rate has not really changed over many years. We're still today, 90% of drugs that are discovered are failing before they reach the market. Everything stems from that. The high price of drugs, the failure rate of curing disease, all stems from this failure rate. If we can improve that probability of success, even 10%, 20%, our cost of drugs would decrease, our ability to cure disease would increase. What I see is processes that are not designed to have a paradigm shift in this probability of success, but are in improvement. What I mean by that is that we're still stuck in this discovery mindset where you're hunting for drugs that are okay, and then you're making those compromises, those okay drugs, better by engineering them. But why can't we design them up front? So I think the most pressing challenges are just this constant failing and processes that allow suboptimal molecules to move forward longer than they should.
So you all work on, I don't know how to call it, but maybe a new modality, right, of mini proteins, which are pretty new. What led you to focus on mini proteins? Tell us what they are. Why are they advantageous, right? Especially in this sort of framework of how you're thinking about designing up front rather than just working with what we have.
So mini proteins are very simple. They're 20 times smaller than antibodies, but equal in power and performance. There's a number of other benefits, but stepping back, 10 to 20 years ago, there were really two main modalities. There were small molecules and antibodies, where small molecules were these toxic chemicals that you would add into your body and you would suffer from toxicity or imperfect binding, or there's all sorts of difficulties in the construction, but they are cheap to make and cheap to consume. Not to mention you can take them orally. Antibodies were discovered from natural forms and they're a natural response in the body, but they're large. They're very large. So large, in fact, that what we've seen over the years, there's a drug resistance that comes from them. As in the oncology field, as the antibodies are trying to get into the tumor microenvironment, it takes too long because they're too big. So the tumor starts to elicit an immune response and picks them out and learns how to fight them off. What we would ideally look for is something that has the small size and penetration ability of small molecules, the targeting of antibodies, because I just listed a negative of antibodies, but they are also very strong binders, very specific binders. And that's what makes them sort of safe drugs in some sense. What we want is something that bridges that gap. And that's exactly where mini proteins come in. At Ordeos, we use the term mini protein a little bit more broadly. So we're covering both the canonical mini proteins. These are 40 to 80 amino acids. So they're very small, up to 10 kilodaltons, where they're typically tightly packed hydrophobic cores. They're nicely charged in such a way that they avoid proteolytic degradation. They are more stable, very high thermostabilities into the 80s and 90s Celsius. But then we also use mini proteins to cover small antibodies. And what I mean by that is single domain antibodies like VHH and VNAR. So these, again, have the specificity of antibodies, but they are easier to manufacture and they're easier to get deeply into membranes. When I say membranes, I don't just mean necessarily the tumor microenvironment, but I also mean membranes. So oral biologics, antibodies, it's really hard to get into an oral format because their large size and charge and all that makes it difficult to cross the epithelial layer of the gut, whereas mini proteins are uniquely suited to survive the pH environment and also to cross the epithelial layer. Same thing with the blood-brain barrier. We see antibodies that might be on the market today that may have some inefficient crossing of the blood-brain barrier, where it's not just going to be the small size, because of course adsorption is one thing, but the small size, the construct, the ability to design them easily will make it easier to cross that blood-brain barrier, leading to more effective neurological medicine. So at the time, we saw a real opportunity where it felt like an unseen path, or a path that was much less traveled. So we made this the center of our business. And so we design mini proteins all day, every day, and we only design mini proteins. There is one subtlety that I'll say. We focus on mini proteins. We don't do peptides. Peptides are wonderful in their own right, but they're smaller than 40 amino acids. So you typically don't have that domain structure that you would in a mini protein. They're normally unstructured or disordered, but they can penetrate deeply into cells. So there's some advantages, but we've focused on mini proteins, which we see as a real opportunity on the market, not just to replace the existing antibodies with maybe something that is more effective at crossing those membranes or getting deep into tumor microenvironments, but also, as I said, creating medicines for where antibodies are not necessarily succeeding today, neurological or in oral delivery.
Yeah. And given that you're venturing into this new area of opportunity, have you found that you've had to build infrastructure or a toolbox around it just because there wasn't anything existing to tap into?
Yes. Mostly on the data side, frankly, because protein, at the end, protein is a protein. I say that with a big grain of salt, so understanding at minimum one difference between mini proteins and antibodies, even single domain antibodies. The binding interface is usually ordered on a mini protein. So you have a binding across something like a helix versus disordered in something like a CDR. And on one hand, the same tooling most is transferable, but on the other hand, it's very important. And so we've had to get into a very careful data creation system where we're creating a large moat mini protein specific data.
Yeah, well, they sound pretty incredible. Is there anything that you're compromising on when you are looking at mini proteins?
The two things that I've heard the most are half-life and the fear of immunogenicity. I'm very careful to say the fear of immunogenicity and not the immunogenicity, because antibodies, they have their own sort of issues, right? You're typically humanizing something that you've taken from a mouse or a monkey, and that is sometimes imperfect, and there's some immunogenicity that comes out of it. The concern with mini proteins is that they look less like the natural repertoire, and so it will be foreign by default. But the thing is, we're designing them from scratch. So we can design them with that immunogenicity in mind and remove that front such that you end up with a safer profile in the end. And then the half-life, again, they are smaller, so they're easier to clear. But there are all sorts of engineering tricks that we can use for that. Simply stabilizing them or fusing them with FCs, pegylating them, adding disordered tails to extend the half-life. There are all sorts of methods to extend that half-life. And what I found is that there are worlds in which antibodies have too long of a half-life, right? So having these shorter half-life mini proteins allows you to configure them. So those are the two main things that we think.
Today, we'll learn more about how generative AI and other technologies are rapidly accelerating the drug discovery process by hearing from InSilico Medicine, who's using AI to create an entirely reimagined drug discovery pipeline from A to Z. Let's go.
Can you talk about a specific application or example of how you're using Gen AI? And looking ahead, what are some regulatory and ethical considerations around IP that we should be anticipating?
Sure. So I actually will tell you a fun story. So I'll also tell you how InSilico got started. And in 2013, one of my colleagues from ATI Technologies, we both worked at ATI, Phil Eisler, he called me up and said that, look, Alex, you know what? You are doing this biotech thing, right? And you are going around talking about AI algorithms. Why don't you come and present at NVIDIA? And NVIDIA has this wonderful conference called GTC, which brings together all of the GPU computing specialists or anybody who is using NVIDIA platform. And while I was at ATI, of course, NVIDIA was a competitor, but a hugely respected one. And Jensen Huang is my personal role model. And I think he is the role model for everyone in this industry, because I know he's probably the best CEO ever living. Unlike Elon, he actually concentrates on one company and also is extremely kind and presents at the level that is probably exceeds Elon's capabilities and manages to find the right technological trends and bet on them with his company, not starting new ones. And I took this opportunity, you know, wanted to see Jensen. And I realized that, you know, in 2013, deep learning started outperforming classical methods, right? Classical machine learning methodologies. And I realized, okay, well, it's time, right? So it's time to start something yourself. So I went to NVIDIA GTC, presented, competed in the Emerging Technology Challenge. They have a startup competition, and also saw Ian Goodfellow present. I saw Andrei Karpathy present, but Andrei presented kind of for convolutional deep neural nets. And everybody was talking about GANs, generative adversarial networks, published by Ian Goodfellow and Joshua Benjo at that time out of University of Montreal. And then Ian moved to Google and then to OpenAI. And I decided to bet everything on deep learning. Right. So basically, InSilico started focusing on deep learning, even in areas where everybody was criticizing deep learning. They're saying they shouldn't do this because other traditional statistical approaches outperform. And we had to explain that, look, we're actually building something much bigger end to end, trying to solve not just one piece of the pharmaceutical drug discovery puzzle, but go and try to solve it all. Right. And for that, we probably need to build the pharma brain, as we call it. So some models will have to be predictive. Some models will have to be generative. Some models will have to be based on convolutional deep neural nets. Some models will have to be feed forwards. And we need to try to go with new technology after classical tasks. Right. And at that time, I didn't even understand the complexity of pharmaceutical drug discovery. So very often, even pharmaceutical drug discovery veterans, they don't know the entire process because they specialize in something very, very narrow. So medicinal chemists sometimes do not understand clinical development, or clinicians that are doing clinical development, they don't understand biology and chemistry. Biologists don't understand chemistry. So we wanted to build this pharma brain. So in 2015, we saw that GANs started producing miracles, right? And decided to, for the first time, to go with this technology after small molecule drug design. So originally, we were very good at solving biological problems with deep learning. So you basically train a deep neural network, for example, to predict a person's age using biological data, and you could identify valuable insights, understand what are the key drivers, learn the fundamental human biology, and then retrain on diseases to identify protein targets that are important in both disease and aging. Published a bunch of research papers on that. But then we thought, okay, why don't we go chemistry? And generative is a perfect application for generation of novel chemical structures, because data availability in chemistry is actually pretty, is there, right? So you can train on hundreds of millions or even billions of structures with different representations. You can do fingerprints, molecular fingerprints, binary representations. You can do text. You can do graphs wave transforms, point clouds. So there are many, many ways to represent the molecule. And there is a huge, vast corpus of knowledge about chemistry with annotation. So we thought, okay, can we use an adversarial autoencoder to generate molecules with the desired properties that are also drug-like? Mm-hmm. And I partnered with a very talented AI scientist who joined us during an AI deep learning hackathon competition that we ran. And he became the first author on this paper, Artur Kadurin, very wonderful scientist. And he did the work where we used molecular fingerprints to generate molecules with the desired properties that may have anti-cancer properties and that are also reasonably novel. And we tried to match the generated molecules with the existing ones and see if we can do well. And we did, published. That was 2016, November, December. We submitted the paper in 2016 in June. And actually, in the meantime, another group at Harvard put their paper on archive using a variational autoencoder. So not a true GAN, but still generative, showing that they can generate also novel molecules with the desired properties using SMILES, text representation of the molecular structure. And now that paper is actually higher cited, well, because it's Harvard, and also it's a very good paper. But I think ours was first. But then, and that was Alana Skuro-Gwudzik's lab out of Harvard. She later moved to the University of Toronto and became the head of the Vector Institute, a very prominent AI research center, predominantly focusing on life sciences and material sciences. And then she later proceeded with, you know, many, many, many innovative papers in this field and us as well. So we were competing. And then we actually partnered. She became one of our advisors and wonderful collaborators. So we started publishing many papers together. And 2017, 2018, our group published many, many theoretical papers using reinforced adversarial autoencoders for small molecule drug design. We used adversarial threshold neural computers, entangled adversarial autoencoders. So many, many, many different models. And then in 2017, we decided that, okay, we're running out of cash. And, you know, one of the pharmaceutical companies we were collaborating with went through, quote unquote, a strategic direction change because it acquired the new chief scientific officer. And at that time, we were quite dependent on the company. But we still decided to, okay, now we need to focus on chemistry and we need to demonstrate that we can go beyond theory and into experimental domain. So we sent our AI-generated molecules out of the entangled conditional autoencoder, selective Janus kinase 3 inhibitors. It's a very famous protein target, lots of information available about it, but it's very difficult to make a selective inhibitor. So we generated a bunch, sent it to a contract research organization in China called Wuxi AppTech. It's a global biotechnology contract research organization. It's a platform that supports so pretty much every pharmaceutical company. It's kind of like Apple. You can design anywhere in the world, but then synthesize and test in Wuxi. So it's a contract research platform, which is phenomenal, best in the world.
Today, we're diving into the world of natural protective antibodies with Alchemab Therapeutics. Alchemab is developing a pipeline of antibody therapeutics for hard-to-treat cancers, neurodegenerative conditions, and infectious diseases. Amrita Sarkar from our team speaks with Young Kwan, the CEO of Alchemab, about his journey, the company's unique approach to drug discovery, and how technology is accelerating their progress. Let's dive in.
Can you tell us a little bit about the unique approach that Alchemab is taking in harnessing the power of antibodies from resilient patient cohorts to develop therapies for hard-to-treat diseases?
Absolutely, I'd be happy to. Alchemab is a very interesting company in that we start with this idea that there are people out there who are resilient to disease, that because of their immune system, they're actually able to fight off diseases that may be impacting other people in a very significant way. And we're all used to thinking about the immune response as it relates to infectious disease. So we think about COVID and testing for COVID antigen and things like that, because we know our immune system is designed to fight pathogenic infectious diseases. However, it can actually also fight other chronic diseases that people don't think about, And AlchemAb was founded to discover these antibodies from people who are fighting these diseases and to identify those and develop those as therapeutics for patients with disease.
I'm interested in why you started working on neurodegenerative disorders and cancer at AlchemAb. From a scientific perspective, what about these classes of diseases renders them particularly interesting for your approach?
Absolutely. So neurodegenerative disorders, I think today, are one of the biggest challenges of our time. I would say that we've made a lot of headway in cancers. Of course, there's many that are still untreated in terms of having success in them, but many great successes in cancer have been achieved to date. And I would say in neurodegeneration, particularly diseases like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease or Huntington's diseases, these diseases are quite tragic in the sense that they are neurodegenerative. There is a course of disease that is unrelenting. And over the course of decades, even though we've identified some of the causes of these to some degree, we still haven't been able to crack them. And so there are many challenges with treating diseases like Alzheimer's. Of course, there have been some recent innovations with the approval of the beta amyloid antibodies, but we're still a long ways away from treating this disease. And so the reason why we chose it was because we feel that AlchemAb has a very unique offering. What we're actually looking for in diseases like Alzheimer's or their dementias is we're looking at individuals who have some level of resilience to the disease, despite having genetic features that might suggest that they should have had the disease by now. So we're looking for outliers that seem to be protected, which may mean they're resisting it. And we take their profiles to look for their antibodies. And so we think that this is a place where if we can identify these really interesting individuals who are able to fight this disease, wouldn't that be a really great area to find unique therapeutic options that haven't been found before? The innovations we have today around beta amyloid, these ideas were first considered 3 or 4 decades ago. So the pace of innovation has actually not matched what we actually would aspire for, I think, as an industry. And so we think we have a unique opportunity in neurodegenerative disorders to find these antibodies in different resilient neurodegenerative patient populations and then bring those to patients. So that's really the reason for neuro, in particular because of the challenges of finding good targets and good potential therapeutics in that area. For cancer, as I mentioned, there's been a lot of innovation, but yet still, there are many oncology disorders that have very poor survival rates. And so we think of two in particular like that. One is pancreatic cancer, where the median survival is really about 10 or 12 months. But there are people who survive 7 or 10 years after diagnosis, after treatment. And one of the questions that we think about is, well, why are those people able to survive when others succumb? Most succumb pretty quickly. And what we have found is that there are individuals who are resilient to this, who have generated their own antibodies that are unique to these resilient individuals that are likely involved in helping them survive. So we're not necessarily saying that these antibodies are the only thing that matter, but we believe that they're an important contributor. And one of the key proofs of concept that we have is that some of these individuals have antibodies that today are used commercially to treat different cancers. We have found checkpoint inhibitors, angiogenesis inhibitors, cytokine inhibitors, and others. And we know today that these pathways are important, not only clinically, but commercially to treat many cancers. So it's a very interesting proof of concept that we can take these resilient cancer patients and find antibodies that one would actually see as their targets and say, yeah, that makes sense. And that's one of the really cool aspects about our platform is that while we're focusing on neurodegeneration and cancer, we think that the potential is boundless. You know, we can work on many different disorders. And so long as there's an idea around the involvement of antibodies, then we think that we have an opportunity to identify those using our core platform, which I know we'll get into.
I'm curious as to your take on the pace at which different dimensions of, let's say, innovation across science, machine learning, and tech have evolved. To give you a concrete example, you were just talking about, scientifically speaking, innovations in the field of neurodegenerative disorders and our understanding of cancers, how some of that is not that recent and has been around for a while. Then we've got, from a machine learning perspective, transformer models that people are exploiting more than ever before, plus the availability of compute resources thanks to the cloud, which is just unprecedented. To what extent have these three individually, or the convergence of these three, allowed a company like Alchemab to achieve your vision?
I would say they've been really critical to help us accelerate our understanding of what we do. We have a publication on a model called Antiberta, which our team put out there a couple of years ago. And I would say that the pace of innovation has been really high in antibody work in this area. And this has been a really cutting edge, because if you think about some of the work around understanding structure of proteins, that's actually been pretty straightforward comparatively, leveraging different tools to be able to predict protein structure. But antibodies are a very unique challenge because, first, they're composed of two different components, a heavy chain and a light chain, each of which contributes to the binding against an antigen, which is the business of what these antibodies do. And that surface may not only be in one chain, it may be in both. And so we know that our antibody diversity, the theoretical diversity that a human can create, is well over probably 10 to the 12. So we're talking about something which is incredibly diverse potential. And so the established AI machine learning tools around protein structure have not yet really been applied and leveraged in the same way for antibodies. So that's what we're doing, is we're really at the cutting edge of that. And the pace of innovation there is incredibly high. What we do with that technology is several fold. One element of it is to help us find that so-called needle in the haystack, that unique resilient antibody. But we also use machine learning to help us understand what could related antibodies look like. So we're converting these amino acid sequences into numbers, right, in our computational work. But then what we want to do is to figure out, can the computational resources help us understand what other antibodies could look like that bind to the same antigen? That's really cutting edge. And so it takes a lot of compute to be able to run large data and algorithms through in order to take enough data, which is the thing that we have to generate, it's hard to come by, to be able to have the computational resources to be able to come back and predict what other antibody sequences could be that bind to the same thing. We think about this as so-called functional clustering. And so these are really important for us because we do these things along every step of our discovery process. We have the computational work and the lab work. It's a very modern discovery approach. And then ultimately, we're using machine learning to help us put together an antibody. We actually are using it to help us predict what could be a good antibody structure. And that's really where I think some of the holy grail is of these approaches, is to be able to develop an antibody almost in silico that does a lot of the heavy lifting. Now, of course, a lot of the validation work is really where the rubber hits the road of testing things in the lab to make sure they work. But our work on the computational side is critical to help us not only look at a large amount of data, but to be able to analyze that and help us make smarter predictions about what antibodies could be binding to what, especially as we grow our own data along the way.
From the perspective of increasing accuracy and shortening the time for development, I assume.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's accuracy is key, because the more accurate we can be, the less lab work we have to do to validate the thing. So accuracy is key. And of course, speed of development is important, because if we're able to leverage the tools to be able to make fewer things in the lab, we can actually go faster.
Thanks for joining us today for the AWS Health Innovation Podcast for part one of our five-part mini-series focused on health innovation. In the coming weeks, we'll feature diagnostics and biomarkers, clinical trials, clinician and patient experience, real-world evidence, and population health. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss our latest episodes. If you want to get in touch with AWS, please check out our show notes where you can find a link. If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to support us is to share it with your colleagues and friends. We also really appreciate your reviews and ratings wherever you listen to podcasts. We love hearing feedback from our listeners, so please don't hesitate to get in touch. Again, you'll find all the details in our show notes. See you next week.